The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Reading again today, I will be from the edition of Time Magazine, dated October 24/October 31, 2022. As usual, Time's front cover is bordered in red. There's no inner white border because the backdrop for the image on the cover is white. Time is superimposed in silvery gray, not really metallic, but a silvery hued gray. Time in large block print. And the cover features an illustration of Abraham Lincoln, top hat in hand, staring down at a chasm in the ground or the universe or however it is to be interpreted. Beginning then with this article, The DC Brief, by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Three dozen states are voting for governor, and every one of those races revolves around the question, how have the Republican nominees embraced or distanced themselves from Donald Trump? Some candidates have contorted themselves into disciples of the former president. Others have conceded Trump is the most powerful force in American politics, shifting from an independent pose into a reluctant convert to the MAGA, M-A-G-A movement. Most, but not all, who stood in opposition to Trump found themselves shown the door. Here are five gubernatorial races to watch, each with the Republican modeling a different posture toward Trumpism. Arizona, the Trump disciple. Carrie Lake is perhaps the avatar of the Trump-styled GOP for a new generation. If Trump asserts something, Lake parrots it. Her opponent, state elections chief Katie Hobbs, has made defending democracy central to her campaign. Arizona is always tricky terrain, but abortion rights may be the wild card for Democrats. Florida, the Trump heir. It is one thing to adopt Trump's brand of politics. It is another to aspire to be the leader of the MAGA movement itself. But that's exactly what's happening in the re-election bid of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Democrats had hoped to dent the DeSantis machine, but Democratic nominee Charlie Crist hasn't inspired much optimism. MAGA marches onward. Ohio, the Trump convert. When the COVID-19 crisis was still in its infancy, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine's quick shutdowns became a model for other leaders. But over time, his approach also became a political liability, so much so that he apologized for mask mandates. He now faces former Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, who has struggled to break DeWine's persistent polling advantage, perhaps a payoff for his conversion to Trump-neutral footing. Oregon, the Trump interloper. Democrat Tina Kotek, the longest-serving speaker of the state House, was expected to have an easy road in a state that last elected a Republican governor in 1978. But the pandemic, its legacy of a recession, protests demanding racial justice, and wildfires have not helped Democrats. That has opened the door for Christine Drazen, a former minority leader in the state house, who refuses to engage in the big lie. She proceeded with complete indifference from Trump. Georgia, the Trump survivor. In 2020, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp did what too few Republicans were willing to do. He told Trump the game was over and certified Joe Biden's victory. Trump wanted revenge. But 18 months later, Kemp won the primary, despite the ex-president's efforts to deny him renomination. Now Kemp is again running against Democrat Stacey Abrams in a grudge match for the ages. Kemp has the advantages that many of his fellow governors covet: a hostile environment for Democrats, an administration from independents who like his steady rejection of Trump's electoral fantasies. Still, it is Georgia, a state that is rapidly changing. Here's a page entitled The View Books, under which it says parenting, great books to teach children about climate change, by Emily Barone and Kyla Mandel. Children today, unlike their parents and grandparents, are growing up in a world that's both experiencing the impacts of climate change and actively adapting to it. They're being introduced to climate change concepts through school, their peers, and kid-friendly TV shows much earlier than their older family members. Fortunately for them and their caretakers, who may feel intimidated by the complex and often frightening topic, there is no shortage of literature to help with the tough job of explaining why the world is changing, what is at stake, and what we can do about it. The best books are those that meet children where they are, both academically and emotionally, in order to give them a space to discuss it and ask questions. Here is an abridged list of books curated by Time and Time for Kids that are suitable for elementary schoolers. The full collection of titles is available on time.com/kids-climate-books. To make the list, we asked for submissions from climate and education experts. We then considered how age-appropriate the material was and whether the tone and storyline left the reader feeling engaged and empowered rather than anxious or overwhelmed. For the youngest kids, experts recommend books that explore the beauty and fragility of nature. As children develop an appreciation for the world around them, they can transition to books that show the cause and effect of how humans treat our planet and why it is important to respect the environment. For older elementary school kids who have begun to grasp the physical nature of greenhouse gases, picture books can illustrate how our use of fossil fuels contributes to global warming. Most of the books on the list also offer lessons about how children, families, schools, and communities can make a difference, a critical message to show that we are all in this together. Thank You, Earth, A Love Letter to Our Planet, by April Pulley Sayer. This photography book captures plants, animals, and landscapes in vivid colors and textures, from up-close images of insects to panoramic vistas of mountain ranges. The pages introduce children to the planet's diversity in a simple but effective way. The Lorax, by Dr. Seuss. Thanks to its rhyme and whimsical illustrations, this classic tale is suitable for young children who can grasp the scarcity of natural resources, and also older kids who can see a danger in valuing profits over long-term environmental harm. We Are Water Protectors, by Carol Lindstrom, illustrated by Michaela Goad. a tribute to indigenous tribes that are protecting the planet. This book metaphorically shows the harms of oil pipelines. Kids will see the value of community action, while adults will recognize the story of the Standing Rock Sioux's fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, by William Kamkwamba and Brian Mueller, illustrated by Elizabeth Zunon. The picture book edition of this memoir recounts the author's teenage experience building a windmill from scrap materials during an extreme drought, an inspiring tale for future clean energy engineers. Polar Bear, Why Is Your World Melting? By Robert E. Wells. This book introduces the greenhouse effect with illustrations showing how sunlight gets trapped. It then explains fossil fuel energy and our reliance on it for electricity and transportation. The pages are chock full of science, but no one section is too dense. Climate Change. The Choice Is Ours. The Facts, Our Future, and Why There's Hope, by David Miles, illustrated by Albert Pinilla. Every left page defines a climate change issue, while every right page features a spin wheel, giving kids the choice of how we can either address the problem or worsen it. Oh, here's a review by SZ, and the name is not spelled out here. It is probably the primary time reviewer, Stephanie Zakarik. Review, A Daughter-Dad Trip Remembered. We have lots of stories about the way boys relate or do not to their mothers. But in the movies, reflections on how girls feel about their fathers, told from a woman's point of view, are still relatively rare. That is the territory of Scottish director Charlotte Wells' gorgeous, resonant debut, After Sun. That is one word, After Sun. The movie begins with an interrogation. It is sometime in the mid-1990s. And 11-year-old Sophie, Frankie Corio, has turned a video camera on her father, Callum, Paul Mescal, who has taken her to Turkey for a rare holiday break. When you were 11, what did you think you would be doing by now? She asks, her innocence the demanding kind, so common in the very young. Callum, whose life we know little about beyond the fact he's separated from Sophie's mother, does not want to answer, at least not on camera. What follows as this father-daughter duo play billiards, explore local ruins, and attempt to scuba dive is a wistful acknowledgement of how little we can really understand about our parents before we become adults ourselves. Anchored by its subtle perceptive performances, After Sun takes place at the point where a father and daughter begin to lose track of each other. Reconnection either happens or it doesn't, but either way, the passage can be bumpy. Once a daughter becomes an adult, she sometimes forgets what her father meant at this time, but After Sun remembers. Another review by SZ, presumably Stephanie Zakarik. A grieving mother forced the world not just to look, but to see. There's a photo here in glowing color. Captioned, Hall and Deadweiler in Till, T-I-L-L. A bond interrupted by unimaginable violence. They're on the platform of a train station. There are porters and a conductor in the background, a silver train car, also multiple silver train cars also in the background. These are people of color in the foreground, and the young man is the same height as the woman standing next to him, his mother. The young man's dressed, decked out in a blue suit, white shirt, and patterned brown and blue tie. He's wearing a blue hat like the kind you used to wear to church, smack dab on the top of his head. And the woman next to him is wearing a lovely yellow print dress, white gloves, a handbag in shades of browns and tan, a yellow hat, just about a pillbox, but it's at the back of her head, and she's wearing jewelry, a lovely ornamental necklace, and what look like button pearl earrings. To the text. The story of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old Chicago youth who was tortured and lynched in 1955 Mississippi for allegedly whistling at a white woman, is one of the most shameful episodes in American history, an event that is still painful to face. Chinonya Chukwu's Till is partly a dramatization of that tragedy, though its chief focus is Emmett's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, played superbly by Danielle Deadwyler, who channeled her intense grief into activism that has profound repercussions to this day. The opening scenes are perhaps the most agonizing to watch. Young Emmett, the incandescent Jalen Hall, radiates optimism as he prepares for a summer trip to visit relatives in Money, Mississippi. His traveling clothes are neat and natty, complete with cufflinks, a patterned necktie, a pressed pocket square. It's Mamie who's nervous. She and her son have never been separated for long, and she explains to him gravely that the Deep South is different from Chicago. Be small down there, she urges him, and he assures her he understands. Meanwhile, her mother Alma, Whoopi Goldberg, assures her that Emmett will be fine, because who could foresee the inhuman cruelty that awaited him? Chukwu, whose 2019 clemency explored the moral consequences of the death penalty, takes care to preserve the harrowing gravity of Mamie and Emmett's story. Though there's no on-camera violence, Chukwu is both direct and respectful in how she recreates one of modern history's most haunting images, that of Emmett's body, battered almost beyond recognition as he lay in his casket. Mamie insisted on keeping that casket open so the world would grasp the viciousness of her son's murder. Till is a perceptive portrait of a mother whose anguish helped galvanize a movement, but it is also a retracing of a permanent scar. Choosing not to look will never be enough to make it disappear. Brief Nation, Education, The Cost of America's Teacher Shortage, by Katie Riley. Shay Brown is uniquely familiar with the nation's teacher shortage. About a week into the school year, she learned that her 9-year-old son, who's in a specialized class for students with autism, would not have a full-time teacher, because there were not enough of them at Patterson Public Schools in New Jersey. Instead, a substitute teacher's filling in. And on September 12, she resigned from her job as a special education teacher in the same district to take a better-paying job at a neighboring school. She knows her decision will make Patterson's situation worse. I take being a special educator very seriously, but I have to care for my children, says Brown, who makes $59,000 per year in Patterson. Her new district, which is about 2 miles away in Prospect Park, is paying her $4,500 more per year. I have to live. I have to pay my bills. Patterson, where a third of the 26,000 students live below the poverty line, had about double the district's normal number of vacant teacher jobs at the end of the school year in June. And the district started this school year with 125 open teaching positions, growing to 137 vacancies as teachers left mid-year. The teacher shortage is likely to keep getting worse. Brown's last day is November 11. The problem in Patterson is reflected in districts across the country. More than half of public school principals reported their school was understaffed entering this school year, especially for special education positions, according to a September U.S. Education Department survey. That is more than double the 20% who said they were understaffed before the pandemic. But as with so much of education in the U.S., this problem is not affecting all schools equally. Several teachers told Time they were leaving Patterson for districts that could pay them better and offered more resources. At least one survey has found that schools in lower-income areas are more likely to have vacancies. Meanwhile, students are suffering the consequences. At Eastside High School in Patterson, nearly 600 students are currently enrolled in science classes that lack a full-time teacher, with four substitutes filling in as the school tries to fill five vacancies for science teachers. A spokesperson for the district said the school's supervisor of science has been uploading lessons and assignments for those students who receive grades via a virtual learning platform. Some students do not have a teacher for their science classes at all and are working on assignments in the school's auditorium under staff supervision. In addition to paying existing staff extra money to cover classes with vacancies, the district says it will soon begin paying teachers a stipend to grade work for classes without permanent teachers. A month into her senior year at John F. Kennedy High School in Patterson, 17-year-old Abriani Lima has permanent gym and English teachers, but has a rotation of substitute teachers in three other classes, where she says she has still received no homework or graded assignments this year. A spokesperson for the district says classes without permanent teachers have assignments posted online every day. It's hard because it's my last year. We actually haven't been in school for almost 2 years, Lima says. Sometimes I just don't feel like going because there's no point in going if I have no teachers. That is exactly what worries Brown, who fears her son will fall behind in writing and math without a certified special education teacher. The pandemic led to some of the biggest declines in academic achievement recorded over the past 50 years and widened the achievement gap between black students and white students. As schools try to help students catch up, their solutions include small group instruction and individual tutoring, which are nearly impossible to offer without enough educators. We are talking about gaps in learning. We are still suffering from COVID, Brown says. I feel like now, with the vacancies, we are never going to be able to catch up. Although surveys throughout the pandemic hinted at a looming mass exodus of teachers, that has not come to pass, and some experts point out that many districts have been using federal relief funds to hire more teachers and staff than they had before the pandemic. Researchers found at least 36,000 vacant teaching positions across the country and at least 163,000 positions that are held by underqualified teachers, according to a working paper published by Brown University's Annenberg Institute in August. Their analysis shows the problem varies widely by state. Mississippi, for example, had about 68 vacancies for every 10,000 students. New Jersey, a state that, alongside cities like Paterson, is also home to some of the wealthiest communities in America, had just one vacancy for every 10,000. And certain districts are struggling more acutely. Schools serving more students of color and schools in high-poverty neighborhoods reported a larger percentage of teacher vacancies than schools serving mostly white students and schools in wealthier areas, according to an Education Department survey from January. Even before the pandemic, high-poverty schools had about twice the teacher turnover rate of low-poverty schools. Public school funding in the U.S. depends heavily on property taxes. As a result, districts serving wealthier white students tend to be better resourced than those serving low-income students and students of color. That is partially why high-poverty districts with less money for teacher raises and other resources are more likely to have teacher shortages right now. In Paterson, where about 60% of students are Latino and 25% are Black, two-thirds of students are considered economically disadvantaged, according to state data. In New Jersey, state money makes up much of the funding gap in poorer school districts. Paterson is in the midst of contract negotiations with the teachers' union, which is calling for increased starting salaries and regular raises. While teachers have long raised concerns about being underpaid and disrespected, the wage gap between teachers and other professions has grown worse over time. In 2021, teachers earned 23.5% less than college graduates with a comparable education level, the biggest gap since 1996, according to the Economic Policy Institute. To try to fill the vacancies, Paterson Public Schools is holding two virtual job fairs each month and is planning to prioritize recruiting new college graduates in December and May. The district is also offering a $7,500 bonus to teachers who sign a two-year contract. But Jess Katz, an English teacher at John F. Kennedy High School, calls the new teacher bonus a slap in the face to educators who worked for the district through the height of the pandemic. She recently resigned from Paterson to transfer to another school, who's paying her $15,000 more and has a theater program, which she says JFK High does not offer. That school also has no teacher vacancies, which means Katz will be able to focus on her own classes without covering for missing colleagues. Once she leaves in November, she says, there will be only two remaining English teachers for juniors at her school, where there were once four. A district spokesperson says some classes have been combined to make up for those resignations, and all classes would be covered by someone certified to teach English. Half our juniors will not have what they need in this crucial year before senior year, Katz says. So far this year, Katz has been asked to use prep periods to cover for other classes with vacancies, but says she is not given enough notice to prepare lessons and is sometimes covering math or science classes outside her expertise. She usually takes attendance and supervises students while they work on assignments for other classes. Brown is still hoping Paterson will make changes, like regular pay raises that would keep more teachers in the district and stem the shortage. This is where you really need to invest, she says. We need a teacher in every classroom. This is not negotiable. The View, The World, The Women of Iran Speak, by Tara Kangarlu. In a country where a man's voice has historically been louder, the women of Iran now lead the fight for change. In the weeks since the innocent death of 22-year-old Mahsa Jina Amini, by the Iranian regime's morality police, the nation's ever-present cry for change has been supercharged by the country's fearless women and girls calling for individual, social, civil, and economic reforms. These unprecedented protests, the largest since the 2009 Green Movement, continue to be met by a systematic crackdown, including the killing and arrest of hundreds of civilians, journalists, and activists. Among those detained are two young female journalists, Niloufar Hamedi and Elahe Mohammadi, without whom the world would have never known about Amini's horrific plight. With every bullet fired and every arrest, the regime is shooting itself in the leg. The Iranian government wants to kill the messengers in order to conceal the truth, but for the Iranian people, the truth is crystal clear. A prominent journalist in Iran, who for security reasons asked not to be named, tells me in a phone interview, "A few nights ago, I saw two teenage girls near my home and on their way to join the protests," the journalist said. "One told the other about her mother not wanting her to leave the house out of fear for her daughter's life. What difference does it make, Mom? The way things are at present, I don't feel like I'm living anyway," the girl told her friend. These leaderless protests comprise a generation that, having seen siblings and parents choke in silence, now vehemently denounces settling for that same life. These teens have witnessed the doomed demonstrations of the past few years. Unlike their older sisters and brothers who've left the country in search of their own dreams, this generation has stayed, only to drown in their parents' suffering under economic hardship. Worse yet, they're confronted with a future that will be contained by the dark shadows of a patriarchal theocracy they find as antiquated as it is barbaric. Their rage is youthful, female-led, and has found common cause with an older generation of protesters, both men and women, who after decades of financial, social, and political confinement feel they have nothing left to lose. I was lucky enough to travel outside of Iran and experience some of the most basic and rudimentary experiences in life without an interfering force controlling every aspect of my life, says a female entrepreneurship advocate and former university instructor in Tehran. Today there are millions of Iranians, especially women, who've suffered from the many corrupt, discriminatory, and demeaning policies of the regime. On top of all that, men and women are equally facing severe financial insecurity at the behest of the government, she explains. Underscoring how Amini's death was a spark to an already inflamed society. But what is taking place on the ground should not be reduced to the women's compulsory wearing of the headscarf or their bodily rights. This is about their fundamental call for freedom. When the 1979 Islamic Revolution overthrew Reza Shah's son, the last monarch of the Pahlavi dynasty, the hijab became mandatory and a major point of contention between the people and the new regime. For the past four decades, the world has seen a 3,000-year-old civilization through the lens of a stifling regime, its nuclear weapons program, and a clergy that has little in common with the majority of its population of 83 million in both practice and ideology, especially its women, and even more so its youth. But the current uproar is about much more than clothing. Iranian women and girls are fighting tooth and nail to claim their freedom of choice and their right to live life as they please. They're fighting side by side with fathers, brothers, and husbands, who for the longest time were presented to them as superior, with the knowledge that their lives should not be defined by a militarized and corrupt theocracy. To support the Iranian women on the ground, it is critical that the international community not regard Iranian women as victims. Rather, they are survivors of a gender-based apartheid state, who against all odds have still managed to make tremendous strides in both public and private life. Iranian men and women are all united in this fight. And while at present they may be struggling to find the leadership needed to bring their movement home, its essence is perfectly summed up in the chant taken up across the entire country, Women, Life, Liberty. The author of this article, Tara Kangarlu, is an Iranian-American journalist and the author of The Heartbeat of Iran and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. The brief, Migrants Rebuild Florida, by Ciara Nugent. Immigrants are arriving to clean up after Ian. And that's the caption for the photo of a devastated community in a low-lying, swamp? Not really, because it's probably an inlet or a small peninsula. There's water on all sides of it. And across the bay or the harbor or the inlet, homes and other buildings are standing intact, flanked by palm trees and the low-lying vegetation of Florida. But in the front of the photo, this place is a wreck. Even the road is all broken up and lying partly underwater. And buildings have either toppled or are falling apart, or the roof has blown off and is something like a block and a half away. There are still the palms standing and the very low growth vegetation, but the people, there are a few people on the scene, are looking at devastation. Three days after Hurricane Ian made landfall in Florida, September 28, as a Category 4 storm, Johnny Aburto arrived in Port Charlotte, a mostly white community of 64,000 popular with retirees on the state's southwestern coast. The town suffered extensive damage during the storm. Roofs blew off, homes flooded. There was a lot of work to be done. Aburto, 42, was there to do it. Originally from Nicaragua, he's part of a large, informal, overwhelmingly immigrant workforce that travels the U.S. cleaning up after increasingly frequent climate-related disasters. Once a hurricane hits, these crews are bussed in by contractors desperate for workers, or they drive to the area themselves and wait in Home Depot parking lots to be picked up for a day's work. Aburto, a skilled laborer, was in New Orleans after Katrina in 2005, Baton Rouge after Louisiana's floods in 2016, Panama City Beach after Michael in 2018, and Lake Charles after Laura in 2020. These kinds of events really affect people, he says. We do our bit to help them. In Port Charlotte, Aburto is busy covering roofs with tarpaulins, a crucial first step to keep homes safe from future rain so power can be restored and residents can come back. He's also cleaning out soaked debris from interiors. When that's done, he says, many will stay on to make more permanent repairs. Florida needs people like Aburto. Ian, one of the strongest storms ever to hit the U.S. mainland, was not only deadly, killing 100 people in Florida, North Carolina, and Virginia, it was also hugely destructive. Insurance claims are expected to reach $57 billion. It may be the most expensive storm in Florida's history. But these workers, who include a mix of documented and undocumented migrants, according to labor statistics, labor advocates, face a strange kind of welcome. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has spent the past year waging a crusade to keep migrants out of the state. In June, he signed a sweeping anti-immigration bill, forcing local law enforcement in Florida to collaborate unusually closely with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. In September, DeSantis used 48 Venezuelan migrants to stage a bit of political theater. With taxpayer funds and false promises of employment, his team flew the migrants from San Antonio to Martha's Vineyard, to the surprise of local officials. DeSantis claimed the stunt would shield Florida from the impact of the Biden administration's relaxation of Trump-era border policies. The chance the migrants come to Florida goes down dramatically, he said. And while DeSantis suspended hostilities with the president in the wake of Hurricane Ian, meeting Biden in person October 5, the governor did not do the same for migrants, using a post-Ian press conference to highlight reports of looting by illegal aliens. DeSantis' statements sting for people like Daniel Castellanos, the 52-year-old director of workforce engagement at Resilience Force, a nonprofit that advocates for disaster cleanup workers. "We are here to help him to rebuild the cities of his state," says Castellanos, who came to the U.S. from Peru. "It's very important to us to help, but it is also very important to be respected." The workers now arriving in Florida have traveled from as far as Louisiana, North Carolina, and even New York, where Texas governor has been busing migrants. Florida's hostile environment will create enormous difficulties for them, says Saket Soni, a labor organization who formed Resilience Force in 2015. In 2018, during cleanup efforts in Bay County, Florida, following Hurricane Michael, Soni says, undocumented workers were routinely detained and transferred to ICE detention. Others were threatened with a call to ICE by their employers when they demanded payment. "Workers have to override enormous fears to keep doing this work," Soni says. So far, the residents of Charlotte County, who voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in 2020, are happy to see the workers, but it may not last, says Castellanos. "They're accepting us right now because they need us, but later, as migrants settle in for months of work, I think there may be some conflicts." Such tensions could be a problem for Florida in the future. Even before Ian, the state's construction industry faced an acute labor shortage. Scientists say climate change is making super destructive storms like Ian a more likely occurrence. DeSantis says Florida must prepare. He has allocated hundreds of millions of dollars to projects to make the state more resilient to extreme weather and appointed a chief resilience officer. At the same time, he's aggressively fought efforts to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Soni hopes the post-Ian recovery could help DeSantis to see that his resilience agenda is not aligned with his migration agenda. Homeowners often express extraordinary gratitude for migrants' work after disasters, he claims. That voter now needs that immigrant worker. People form new relationships after tragedies. The brief health. Why taking a phone break is so good for you. by Angela Haupt. That needy black rectangle you carry around everywhere you go, you are probably too attached. Although it is not formally recognized as an addiction yet, problematic smartphone use interferes with many aspects of life, says Jay Olson, a postdoctoral scholar in psychology at McGill University, who's researched the topic. It could be interfering with your concentration. It could be that you feel less social when using your phone. It could be you are sleeping less well because you are staying up late scrolling. Those signs likely sound familiar because smartphone overuse affects almost anybody who has a device at this point, says Dr. Anna Lemke, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, who wrote a book about the dopamine hits we get from our screens. The digital content is just so enticing, and we have such easy access. Smartphone use also intensified during the pandemic's first lonely years. But failing to separate from your screen could have harmful implications. Research links smartphone overuse to a wide array of physical and mental health issues. People who are fused to their phones tend to get worse sleep and less of it. And according to a review published in Frontiers in Psychology in August, smartphone overuse can exacerbate anxiety and lead to psychiatric symptoms, stress, and depression. All that scrolling also derails your time and attention, leaving less to spend on healthier pursuits like exercise and spending time with loved ones. Taking some space from your phone, even for short amounts of time, can help restore your balance, attention, and even faith in humanity. I think disconnecting matters to everyone, says Adam Alter, a professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business, who wrote a book about addictive technologies like smartphones. It matters to kids who develop stronger social skills and relationships when they are not behind screens. It matters to adults who are more likely to connect with others when they spend time offline rather than glued to their screens. And it matters to communities, which are impoverished when their public spaces are filled with hundreds or thousands of people sitting in public but spending time alone behind screens. How to disconnect from your phone? There are six hints here. You do not have to sacrifice your device. Small changes can make a big difference. Experts recommend these research-backed strategies. Batch your notifications. Disable the sounds and banners that flash across your screen, notifying you you have a new Facebook message, email, or TikTok video to watch. Instead, batch them so they all come at once, either hourly or less frequently. Research indicates that doing so can reduce stress. Hide social media apps. Drag all your social and email apps into one folder that is not displayed on your home screen, so it takes some work to open them, Olson suggests. Even better, delete them from your phone and access them only via your laptop, which can dramatically cut down the amount of time you spend on them. Put your phone out of reach. Much of our phone use is mindless, so putting up these little barriers, like keeping it behind you, face down, can be effective, Olson says. Keeping it in another room while you sleep is a particularly helpful strategy, he adds. Make your phone more annoying to unlock. Instead of taking advantage of convenient features like Face ID, use a passcode that you have to enter manually. Researchers have found that having such a delay before accessing your phone can reduce usage. Gray out your screen. Sapping all the color from your display through the grayscale setting can help reduce screen time and anxiety. It makes the phone a little less attractive, Olson says. We are kind of conditioned to click those notifications, and when they're black and white, they are a bit less salient to us. Make a list before you pick up your phone. Make a list of exactly what you want to accomplish by using it. Maybe checking your email, finding a dinner recipe, and messaging a couple of friends. After you pick it up, do not do anything that is not on your list, Lemke suggests. The View Opener, a risk report by Ian Bremmer. After the election, Lula will face tough times in Brazil. That's Lula. The first round of Brazil's presidential election, held in early October, promised greater drama to come. The lead story from those results was that President Jair Bolsonaro trailed challenger and favorite Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva by just 5 points. 48.4% to 43.2%, about half the margin pre-election polls had led us to expect. Lula, president of Brazil from 2003 to 2010, remains likely to win the second round runoff October 30, but the challenges ahead for him and for his country will be daunting. For Lula, election victory is where the good news ends, because a better-than-expected performance by right-wing parties that support Bolsonaro in Congress and in many races for state governorships will limit Lula's ability to advance an ambitious economic and social agenda. His victory will come largely thanks to promises to boost economic and social support for Brazilians who need it during tough economic times. But determined resistance from opposition lawmakers will frustrate his ability to raise taxes and increase government spending. In fact, the PL, Bolsonaro's party, will be the largest single party in both houses, and opposition parties of the right will now hold half the seats in Brazil's lower house. Lula might still manage to build a working coalition in both houses by cutting deals with centrist and independent parties, as well as with moderate lawmakers who align with pro-Bolsonaro parties for tactical reasons. But that would force Lula into the compromises that undermine his plans to spend state money to help consumers weather inflation and to ease growing inequality. The immediate market response to the first round results was positive. Both the currency and stock prices strengthened. In part, that is because investors who fear that Lula will tax and spend Brazil into fiscal trouble saw great hope in the numbers for a Bolsonaro second round upset. The incumbent, many investors believe, would keep market-friendly reforms moving through Congress. But it is also because they recognize that even if Lula wins, he will face much greater legislative resistance than he had to contend with during his first presidency. Markets may also like the fact that despite his party's gains, Bolsonaro's opposition bloc will not have the votes to destabilize Brazil's politics by amending its constitution or by trying to impeach Lula. What we see in Brazil is part of a larger trend across Latin America. Economic slowdowns in China and America are weighing heavily on growth. Global inflation is surging. Governments have few tools to manage it. In many countries, voters have ejected right-wing incumbents in favor of left-wing candidates who pledge state help. But domestic opposition and poor economic conditions abroad prevent them from delivering, increasing the risk of protests and destabilizing political unrest. Chile was rocked by noisy demonstrations before the pandemic took hold. Colombia saw violence in the lead-up to elections that produced that country's first leftist president. Brazil has seen massive demonstrations before over issues like fare increases on city buses. This is what Lula has to look forward to. There's the more immediate problem for Brazil that Bolsonaro's ready to cry foul if he does not win. For months, he's laid the groundwork for claims the vote has been rigged against him, and the closer-than-expected first-round result will make matters worse by convincing his supporters he has a real chance to win in the second round, and that polling is not to be trusted. But Bolsonaro will have fewer options to challenge than Donald Trump did following his loss to Joe Biden in the U.S. 2020 presidential election. Brazil's federal election system means Bolsonaro cannot try to use state governments to manipulate the outcome, and there's no evidence that suggests Brazil's military leadership is more willing than the Pentagon was to launch a coup on behalf of a defeated incumbent. For Brazil these days, that's as good news gets. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.